Hello and welcome to Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles. Today we welcome Dr. Kevin Campbell back to the podcast.
He's a cardiologist, the CEO of a health data startup called Pacemate, and he's a big KOL. He's also a member of our editorial advisory board.
Speaking of which, if you like Databook, check out our magazine, Healthcare Analytics News. You can find it online at hcanews.com or on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
So in a moment, Dr. Campbell is going to discuss a very buzzy concept, artificial intelligence.
That's AI for the uninitiated.
And he's going to help us understand what exactly this technology can do for healthcare. But before that, he's going to help us clear up some common misconceptions.
And the truth is, Jack, that there are tons of those.
And they all add up to a sort of fog that comes to surround AI. And this cloud of misunderstanding, it can get so thick and powerful that it can influence really important decisions regarding AI.
We're talking about research, funding, even the way you and I think of AI.
So today, we've got just the story to show you what we mean.
It's the story of a math whiz named James Lighthill.
Sir James Lighthill.
The man who wrote a report that almost destroyed AI as an academic discipline.
And the really chilling part? Many experts argue that he didn't really understand the very technology he almost crushed.
For a long time, philosophers and writers and artsy types dreamed of a technology that could mimic the human brain. Something that was mechanical, but also capable of decision-making and problem-solving.
Way back in 850 BC, the Greek author Homer wrote about some sort of manufactured, intelligent being that helped this crippled god walk. And even 200 years before that, over in India, philosophers described a pretty similar vision.
But for the vast majority of human history, the idea of artificial intelligence was just that, an idea.
Then come the 1950s and the slow rise of computers. Sure, they were primitive, but for the first time, some very smart people begin to see a possible path toward the kind of artificial intelligence that had captivated humans for, well, forever.
So there's Alan Turing, for starters, and a bunch of other experts and papers. And in 1956, the academic field of AI is born at a conference in Dartmouth College.
And soon enough, governments start handing out multi-million dollar grants.
In the US, a lot of that money comes from DARPA, the military's technology arm.
And over in the UK, the funding comes from civilian public coffers.
So researchers are using this money to investigate all sorts of things. Natural language processing, search, robotics.
And they make some big strides. But along the way, they also learn that this whole AI thing, it's not going to be easy.
They find out that the road ahead is going to be very long and challenging.
And in publicly funded science, that type of trajectory can spell trouble.
The backers, the governments, they want some bang for their buck. They want results, and they don't want to wait 50 or even 100 years to get them.
So by the 1970s, Britain takes a step back and says, hey, let's look at what AI research has accomplished. What have these scientists done with the millions and millions of dollars we've given them? And should we give them any more money?
So to answer those questions, England calls upon a respected academic who was knighted just the year prior.
Enter Sir James Lighthill. James Lighthill was born in 1924, and he went on to become an applied mathematician. His work, though, branched out to a bunch of fields: astrophysics, biology, aerodynamics. He even created two fields: nonlinear acoustics and biofluid dynamics.
Basically, Lighthill was a big deal. He held top positions in the UK's top universities. Stephen Hawking even took one of his jobs after he left. So he was definitely no ordinary academic. Some of his peers even called him a genius.
In 1973, a major AI lab in Edinburgh wanted to buy an expensive machine from abroad. A government body called the Science Research Council was on the hook to pay for it. But before it would shell out the money, the council decided to examine AI's progress.
And to do that, they turn, of course, to Lighthill.
So he spent 2 months looking at AI research across the world. He spoke with dozens of experts from various backgrounds, and he scrutinized the findings of more than 20 years of research.
In the end, he came up with a report that he described as a highly personal view of the AI field.
And his findings?
They were not good for AI.
That's right. Lighthill wrote that he supported AI when it came to industry automation and even computer simulations that could help researchers in other fields.
But he absolutely blasted language processing. He blasted robotics, too. He blasted the very existence of AI as a research discipline. He said it was just a bridge between computer science and neuroscience.
Lighthill basically said, hey, AI is not going to happen. You just can't make machines intelligent like people.
He pointed to fundamental challenges that had long puzzled AI researchers. Then he said, AI will never work in the real world. It will never be more than an interesting idea. AI won't result in anything beyond a few robots, maybe designed for the lab.
This report made AI researchers very angry.
Frankly, it's making me kind of angry, Jack. But let's go on. We must move ahead.
Yeah, don't be mad.
These researchers saw it as an attack on a cornerstone of their very lives.
You see, they had spent decades trying to solve the insanely complex problems that Lighthill had analyzed for only a few weeks. And they had made progress. But they knew 20 years was not enough time to get it right.
These AI researchers also saw fatal flaws in Lighthill's argument. They saw deep-rooted misconceptions about what AI was and what the researchers were trying to accomplish.
And that still happens a lot today. How many people think of robots rather than lines of code when they think of AI? Probably a bunch.
So the debate over AI really picks up after the so-called Lighthill report is published. And what happens next?
A literal televised debate.
Somehow, some way, the AI question generates so much buzz, this is back in the 70s, that the BBC puts Lighthill in front of the camera before an audience of scientists. It's June 1973.
And it's for this debate show called Controversy, which probably would not exist today. And Lighthill goes up against not one, not two, but three of AI's founding fathers.
These three guys, their names are Richard Gregory, John McCarthy, and Don Michie.
These are the folks who are trying to change the world with AI. So it's no surprise that they're also some of AI's biggest promoters.
So Lighthill kicks off the debate with a scathing statement. He says general purpose AI robots are a mirage.
Which right there is kind of weird, because again, AI is not limited to robots. It's all about algorithms, even though a lot of research at the time did involve robots.
Lighthill compares AI research and robots to the entertainment industry. He again highlights technical challenges, and then he says AI researchers shouldn't be upset. Here's a quote.
They should feel encouraged by evidence of the uniqueness of man, uniqueness of the human race.
That's a good one. The AI field had its chance, Lighthill argues, but now time is up.
So Gregory, McCarthy, and Michie, they come back with several different arguments, and their points sound strong, especially right now with the benefit of hindsight.
So we have these two opposing sides going back and forth, back and forth.
And they debate the tiniest details and the broadest strokes. They're all over the place.
And they come to earn lots of applause from the audience.
And at times, the experts on both sides of the argument look and sound really annoyed.
As if they can't fathom where their opponent is coming from.
How on earth could he think this way?
McCarthy, who helped establish Stanford's AI lab, says the science behind this field will continue to grow even after he's out of the game.
Lighthill says none of their children will ever see real-world meaningful AI. It's not even on the horizon. And as such, AI researchers shouldn't get another dime.
And you know what? They don't.
Not really, at least for the next decade.
Because even though Lighthill had some pretty glaring misconceptions about AI, the UK listened to him.
Even though he'd be proved wrong in the future, Lighthill won that debate. He won it the second his report came out.
So AI funding in England almost completely dried up.
And that had ripple effects across the rest of Europe. And the US had already begun to cut funding for AI before this whole debacle started.
AI research became confined to just a few select institutions.
And the world entered what's known as an AI winter.
That's a period when investments and belief in the technology go completely cold.
And this particular AI winter, it lasted for more than 10 years.
As we all well know now, the Lighthill report did not mark the end of AI research.
But you could argue that it slowed the pace of AI's evolution. That's what happens when the money goes.
In the 80s, funding returned. and it disappeared again in the 90s, and now it's coming back.
It did, but AI is still viewed very skeptically and in some cases with a lot of hostility.
For not being good enough or for being so good that it could wipe out us humans.
And who knows, maybe AI will be our demise. But right now it's clear that the tech has a lot to offer healthcare, from health systems and providers to patients and payers.
The thing is, if we don't try to understand what AI is and what AI isn't, we risk a second coming of the Lighthill Report.
And it's not that Lighthill was entirely wrong, but looking back on him and his arguments, a lot of experts agree that his talk of robots and AI as a bridge between disciplines was just off.
And now we can point to examples. He criticized AI programs of the early 1970s for not being able to defeat the world's top chess player in a match. He didn't think that would ever happen.
And sure enough, an IBM computer eventually did just that back in 1997. Also, he thought that AI would never be able to translate languages. And that still might not be perfect, but go to Google and search Spanish to English. It's almost there.
Yeah, we're certainly making some headway. But in the end, you know, we have these AI researchers, they're winning. They got a lot of money. They made the advances. And now AI is an integral part of our lives, from Google Maps to Facebook's facial recognition feature.
But to clear up what exactly AI is and what it means for healthcare, we figured that it would be smart to bring on Dr. Kevin Campbell, the cardiologist KOL who heads the health startup Pacemate.
We talked to him this week to make sense of all this and to identify AI's importance to healthcare now and in the future.
So, Kevin Campbell, welcome to Databook.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy chatting with you guys, and I think this is a very important podcast, and I hope that the listeners, when they finish listening to this episode, feel that way as well.
To get started, what exactly is AI, machine learning, and deep learning? What are the differences between these buzzy terms?
It's actually a pretty complex matter that I like to think of it almost like the nesting dolls that you see from Russia, the Matryoshka dolls. So if you think of AI in general as the biggest outermost doll, in simplest terms, it's the simulation of human intelligence by computer systems. And the concept of AI really has been around since the 1950s, but obviously in the last decade, it's really taken off. And AI allows machines or computers to perform tasks that normally would require human intelligence, such as visual perception, speech recognition, and decision making. You hold in your hand a mobile device, whether it's an iPhone or an Android or some other mobile device that actually has these types of capability. Now, if you think of the next layer inside that Matryoshka doll is machine learning. And machine learning is a type of AI, but it uses algorithms to break down and analyze data. It actually learns from the data and ultimately can make decisions, determinations, and predictions. So as you can see, machine learning can be very important in medicine. Machine learning really occurs when a computer actually evolves and learns without specific pattern of programming because it just recognizes patterns. With machine learning, a computer is able to honestly modify itself when exposed to new data. The innermost doll of the nesting dolls or the Matryoshka dolls is deep learning. And deep learning is a subset of machine learning. And in deep learning, algorithms, artificial neural networks, it's a computer term, these are all used to recognize patterns. And then they put data in clusters and they classify data. Deep learning really just maps inputs to outputs and finds correlations. Almost like when a computer learns how to play chess, it learns the consequences or the rewards of a particular move that you make on the chessboard. Honestly, when doctors make a treatment decision on a particular disease, that's what we do. We are doing what deep learning is. We are predicting responses based on complex patterns.
We know how all these things can help other industries out there. We just named a few, but how can these technologies help healthcare?
The applications in healthcare are limitless. They really are. Because if you can imagine, just think about the human genome. When we tried to create the genome project and tried to process all those genes and all those patterns and then map them to particular types of cancer, particular types of mutations that may cause cancer, that takes forever. But IBM, for example, is using Watson and the oncology project to actually use AI, machine learning, and deep learning to map certain types of gene patterns to particular cancers. So that's a really important example of how this might work. You know, I think that you're going to see AI-equipped medical applications and tools on smartphones and mobile devices that really may revolutionize the way we practice medicine. And I think ultimately what you're going to see is that AI is going to make personalized medicine actionable and available to every single person on the planet. Right now, as doctors, we make treatment decisions based on big studies of population. What if we can make treatment decisions based on your DNA, based on your personal makeup? And we do that through the use of artificial intelligence and these machine learning type algorithms, and then the deep learning that can predict what we're going to see.
What are some good examples of how AI is improving healthcare right now?
AliveCor has a Cardia device, which is a mobile ECG that you can do from your Apple Watch or you can do from your smartphone itself, Android or Apple iPhone. And what happens is this company has already got AI and algorithms in place that can discern whether this is a normal ECG tracing or an abnormal ECG tracing. So it's very, very powerful. Google has DeepMind Health, which, you know, is actually looking to develop ways to detect macular degeneration and aging eyes through cameras and pattern recognition. IBM Watson Oncology is driving change in treatment decisions using patient medical information and history to optimize the selection of treatment options. So it's going through all these options much faster than we can as human beings. There's lots of companies that are out there working. One company is called Skin Vision, and this is basically a skin cancer risk app. And what it does is looks at pictures of skin and creates through AI a predictive model of your likelihood of developing skin cancer. And we talked about predictions, particularly with deep learning. We know that we can predict certain outcomes. Well, imagine epidemic outbreaks and predicting outbreaks of malaria or Ebola or other devastating illnesses. Right now, we can use AI, machine learning, and deep learning to work on predicting these types of epidemics. And we're seeing that used more and more commonly. And, you know, it's not mainstream, but this is the future.
As with any new technology, there's obviously a ton of excitement and hype around AI. But at the same time, there's going to be some big concerns. Can you point to a few?
Well, first of all, you have to think about privacy and data governance. You know, that's a really pressing issue if you want to think about the fact that medical data is very personal. And we have laws that make sure that it's not easy to access. But in order to make AI mainstream and actually make this work, there's going to have to be some data sharing. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to share personal data in a way that doesn't violate privacy laws or violate your law as a patient. Certainly, I think that we need transparent algorithms. We need to make sure that when we use AI to produce a treatment decision and then ultimately produce a treatment for the patient, we need to make sure that people can look into those algorithms and understand why that treatment decision was made the way it was. Breaking down these sort of data silos that happen in medicine and industry, because one particular company may want to keep their data separate from another competitor because they want to corner the market on a particular drug. But until we share data and have open access to data, we're going to continue to evolve very, very slowly when it comes to things like AI, deep learning, and machine learning as well. So I think certainly there is many, many challenges when you think of that, but also the challenges of recruiting new talent, artificial intelligence enthusiasts, those that are really good at understanding these types of technologies. You know, we need to train more people in the field.
So let's say that AI takes hold in healthcare and becomes a part of the medical establishment. What does the future look like?
You know, I'm very excited about the potential of AI. You know, some people say, well, oh my goodness, you're replacing the doctor-patient relationship with a machine. In actuality, I think AI will enhance our ability to develop doctor-patient relationships because in this world of nonstop data and data that must be processed, physicians spend far too much time processing data by hand. If we can use machines and machine learning to process these data for us, it gives us more time to understand our patients, to bond with our patients, to be real doctors. So I think that you're going to see actually back to basics in healthcare, in that your doctor will have more time to spend with you because a lot of the other stuff that we normally are having to do will be automated. I think when you go into a hospital or a clinic, you're going to show your iPhone and your doctor is going to be able to scan your iPhone and know your genetic code. And when they get that genetic code, they're going to be able to talk to you about your symptoms, put your symptoms into a computer. Your genetic code is combined with the symptoms, and then AI, machine learning, and eventually deep learning will make a diagnosis. The doctor confirms that diagnosis with history and physical exam and back to basics medicine, and then a treatment is prescribed. And I think you're going to see much quicker, more appropriate treatments, because doctors are really good and we try really hard to get everything right. But, you know, we're human beings and machines are far superior at processing large amounts of data. So I see the combination and the meeting and the melding of both machines, AI, as well as physicians caring for patients every single day.
All right, Dr. Kevin Campbell, everybody, CEO of Pacemate. Thanks for joining us this week on Databook.
Well, that's it for this episode of Databook. That's our ninth one in the books, and we want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this show. We also want to thank MJH Studios, which recorded this episode and graciously allows us to do that every week.
They are the best, and I'm not just saying that because they're listening to us right now. So anyway, you know where to find us, everybody. Hit us up on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Jack and I also have our own accounts, so you can come find us there. And be sure to visit us again on hcanews.com.
That's healthcare analytics news. And if you are using a healthcare app that you think is making a big difference and doesn't have the attention it deserves, let us know. HCA_news. We'll put it in the August print edition of the magazine.
We're all ears, everybody.
Well, have a great weekend.
See you next week.